Good afternoon and welcome to Time Out, your program of informative interviews with persons of note, persons with fascinating careers, leaders of today and tomorrow, and others who will allow you to invest an hour and receive a guaranteed valuable return. So stay tuned. This is Bill Hendrickson, your host of Time Out on a hot day in Carrboro, North Carolina. But we have a hot show for you today. We have a person with us who is kind of tied close to this station. Number one, Tim Hux is an underwriter of this particular show. Number two, Tim Hux and his friend Bob Ward come to the station at least twice a year and talk about sports, of which they are extremely knowledgeable, particularly if the sports affect the word tar and heels. So, but today we're going to talk with Tim about his real life. He is a professional investment advisor, and he has a business called Rising Tide. And did you figure that name out yourself?
Well, I did. You know, I had a little help from John F. Kennedy in this. When he was a president, I believe, he talked about rising tide lifts all boats and our economic prosperity. So right. I just figured I'd glom on to the economic prosperity part. So far, so good.
Well, you are a Tar Heel through and through. You went to the university, right?
Right.
And your children went to the university.
Two out of three.
Okay. And did your wife?
Yes. I met her in graduate school back in 1978.
Wow. And do you have other relatives of the Tar Heel fame, or just intimate family we're talking about?
Just most of my my immediate family. As a matter of fact, I was the first person in my family and my cousins, as far as I can remember, to graduate from a four-year university.
Are you a native of this area?
I grew up in High Point, North Carolina.
Okay, well, that's just down the road a piece. And you came up here as a student, and you have this investment advisory service, but that's not how you started your adulthood, is it?
No, I started my adulthood by getting older. I actually, it's interesting because I would suggest this to any individual that has any concern about going to school or getting an education or maybe even going back and going to graduate school. Hard labor is a wonderful thing because it teaches you what you don't want to do. Okay. I was a garbage man while I was in college. All right. During the summer. I worked as a house painter. When I got a degree in psychology, it qualified me to be a house painter.
Okay, well, that makes a lot of sense.
So working one day in November, and it was cold, and I was on the ladder, and I said, I'm going back to graduate school. So I got a master's in counseling from the University of North Carolina, became a school counselor. First job at Goldsboro, North Carolina. I was just talking to your previous radio host. Told him that I coached basketball and coached against Michael Jordan two games.
Against
that
year. Michael Jordan. Where was he?
He was at Wilmington Laney.
Is that where he grew up? Okay.
Yep.
Okay. So you coached basketball two games against Michael Jordan. Do you have a shirt or something that?
No. All I have. Well, yes, yes. As a matter of fact, now I won't take a whole lot of time with this, but. So, second game, we won the first game by 1 point at his place. And they came to our place, and it was at the end of the season, and we'd gotten better. And we were up by a wide margin. I put my bench players in. He came off the bench. Not Michael came off the bench, but Michael stole a ball around half court, took one step inside the free throw line, and took off and dunked it. And he was only about 6'2 at the time. And
was he a senior in high school?
No. He was a sophomore. Oh, this was a JV game.
And I
looked at my assistant coach, and I said, we don't do that. We don't do that in this league. Who was that? I looked at the book. It said Mike Jordan. Not Michael, but Mike Jordan.
Okay.
Okay, well, whoever that is. So I quickly learned who that was the following year and the year after.
And forever.
So – many years later, my wife was doing something called an homage quilt. My wife, Patty, was doing an homage quilt, and she had swatches of cloth signed with Sharpies folks that she admired, like Dean Smith and Bill Friday and Oprah Winfrey and so on. And so she decides to write to Michael. She tells him this story. She says how much she admires his parents, and she sends it off to Chicago.
Uh-huh.
You know, Michael Jordan, Chicago Bulls. I don't know what address she had. About 6 weeks later, I go out to the mailbox, and there's this envelope with this gold embossed Jumpman logo on it. And I go, oh! And he had written back, very nice note, sign all three swatches. So, no, I don't have a shirt, but we do have three signed swatches.
Okay, well, that answers that question.
From Michael Jordan.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You and the last two shows prior to this show were men who started out in teaching. Last week I talked to Mark Kleinschmidt, who's the clerk of courts of Orange County.
Right.
And a week before that, I talked with Luke Everett, who teaches at the UNC Law School, and he started out teaching. Both of those men started out teaching in public schools, I guess public schools, for about 4 years before they got even went back to get their law degree.
Now, I'm not going to diss teachers because I still work with teachers today as a volunteer, and I think that they are unsung heroes.
Oh, I believe that, too. Right.
But we started to have a family. And it was either scrimp. We qualified for food stamps.
Okay.
That's how tough it is in North Carolina. I don't know if it's gotten better. My guess is not a whole lot. So I really had to do something else because mom wanted to stay home with the children.
So how did you evolve into what you're doing now?
Well, actually, I got hired by John Hancock in 1981 while I was still teaching, and I got to essentially do a trial run for a few months. And I just did – basically, I just did what they told me to do. And it's amazing. Effort and persistence are a whole lot more valuable in a successful career than intellect any particular talent, unless you happen to be in the NBA.
Unless you're the son or daughter of somebody.
Well, there you go. So I gravitated, you know, they taught me I have an insurance background, a life insurance background, as well as annuities. But they taught me about mutual funds.
Yeah.
And I decided to gravitate toward the investment side of the business, worked with a couple other firms. But in 1993, went out on my own, hooked up with Charles Schwab as a custodian of investment accounts, and currently do some business with Schwab, Fidelity, TIAA. They're my three primary because I do a lot of university retirement work.
But those are the people who support what you're doing. And to make income for yourself, you have to have clientele.
Right.
So how did you develop people who wanted to deal with you?
Well, when I first started out, what I did was I identified folks from the news. And not, you know, newspapers were much more prevalent than
that's true.
Than
even
they are
local,
now.
Even local papers,
so
right around here.
So folks that would get promoted, folks that would move into the area, in various and sundry ways. I even filled out direct mail lists and sent out 50 a week, promising them free pocket atlas. Now, can you imagine how well that would go over today?
I know.
They'd say, what's an atlas? I'd say, Google it. So, yeah, it was different. Things are different today.
How many years ago was this? When did you start this process?
Well, 38 years.
Okay.
38 years. And it was pretty hard work for a while.
So you had to convince people at the outset that they wanted to deal with you, and they didn't even know you.
That's correct.
You had maybe some friends and family, but...
Yes, some friends and family, but the main thing is develop trust, and I think the way you develop trust is to be honest and to be reliable. Do what you say you're going to do. Never tell somebody you're going to call them back and then don't do it. Always follow up if they have a question. If you don't know the answer, find it. you know, just do the things that you're supposed to do to be a good human being and a good business person.
So I think, and I went to your website, and one of the your famous words is relationships, which is you're talking about now.
I am in the relationship business.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Because if I don't have relationships and I don't have clients, and if you don't have clients, well, you understand where that goes.
So early on, then, the clients, you found a client, and one client led to others, and the referral. Did you get referrals early on?
Yes. Yeah, and it's not, you know, nobody is necessarily a font of referrals, but a lot of folks will suggest one person or two or maybe three.
Uh-huh.
And you just have to be a good ambassador for your business and a good trustworthy person for your client.
But as far as you mentioned other companies that you deal with for certain assistance that you need, but as far as the client is concerned, it's you.
Correct. Correct.
And this relationship and this trust that you develop helps you lead to new clients. Your clients are mostly individuals. Do you have any institutions?
The only non-individual clients I have were the small business clients.
Okay.
And they're run by individuals, and I don't think that I work with any company that has more than five or six employees.
So the investment value that you create is with the individual, or maybe including the employees if you happen to have a little pension fund.
Right, so there'll be a little bit of retirement account. There'll be some company retirement accounts. They're not huge.
What are the popular retirement accounts today? What kind of activity are you involved
with? You
know,
most of the things that I do are either solo 401ks, which weren't available until a few years ago. They're just like a regular company 401k. An individual under age 50 can put away $18,000 a year.
Uh-huh.
The company can put some money in as profit sharing if they want. In addition to that, if you're over 50, you can pump it up to $24,000 a year. And if you run your own company, then you can put in the maximum amount as a salary deferral, and you can also put in 25% of your salary as a profit-sharing contribution. So it's relatively lucrative for a self-employed individual.
Mm-hmm.
Also, if you have several employees and you're not related to those employees, something that's easy to work with is called a simple retirement plan. It's actually IRAs for the folks that are participants, and they have certain amounts that they can contribute and certain amounts that the business matches. So I keep it very small, very simple.
Well,
don't try to do anything that's overly complicated.
Well, everything that you said in the last four or five sentences has to do with various regulations.
Absolutely.
Your world is highly regulated.
That's the truth. So I want you to know right now that anything I say today is not a solicitation. It is not a recommendation. It's my own opinion and my own story, and has nothing to do with the radio station or any other institution.
Okay, well, that wipes out this conversation. Well, thanks for clarifying it. Boy, that's fascinating. You sent me some good notes today, which complement some of the things I sent earlier, such as dealing with these various elements of investments. Exchange-traded funds, mutual funds. I was asking a guy I deal with, tell me, what's the difference between mutual funds and ETFs?
Mutual funds have been around for a long time.
I used to sell them. I had a license years ago.
I think Massachusetts Financial Services started those out of Boston in 1920-something,
probably,
perhaps.
Yeah.
I used to know that better than I know it now.
Well, you don't need to know it.
exchange traded funds have been around, most of them within the last decade, a couple, 20 years. Exchange traded funds are bought and sold daily, or can be bought and sold daily, just like an individual stock. They are priced to the, well, I'll just say to the minute. It's probably to the second and maybe to the millisecond. But you can, they change prices during the day. A mutual fund does not. It has a net asset value price at the end of each trading day. So essentially, if a mutual fund has 100, let's say it's a stock fund, if it has 100 different stocks in it, the pricing of those stocks is calculated at the end of each day, and then you get what's called a net asset value, and okay, that's what you can buy the share of a mutual fund for.
Okay.
And an exchange-traded fund, they are baskets of securities as well, but they tend to get – they can get very specific. It could be just oil and gas. It could be materials such as copper, gold, silver.
Yeah.
It could be the entire S&P 500. It could be the Dow Jones Industrial Average. It could be the NASDAQ 100. So it has a very specific focus, and they are usually less expensive than mutual funds, well, and sometimes yeah, significantly less expensive than mutual funds.
Okay, but you've got these baskets, and somebody has to decide what's in the basket, or is this not – is it automatically?
It's usually there's an index associated with whatever is in that basket. So it could be a commodities index. It could be a technology index. And these indexes are being created almost all the time. And major fund companies sponsor ETFs. So it could be Fidelity, could uh-huh, be Invesco, could be a lot of different PowerShares, iShares, could be a lot of different companies that create these exchange-traded funds.
So the fund the basket doesn't necessarily adjust every day.
No.
The mutual funds, no. I think there's people that make changes more frequently.
Well, right? They're what you call actively managed funds or passive funds. And there are active ETFs and there are passive ETFs. In a passive, it does exactly what the name implies. The S&P 500 would be the index, and yeah, it would match the percentage. You know, for instance, Microsoft is a roughly 4% of the S&P 500. So on your ETF for the S&P 500, you'd have roughly 4% of that in Microsoft.
Uh-huh. Somebody's fooling around with the phones here. Okay, go ahead, Tim. Don't let them interrupt you.
We have interlopers in the radio station.
Well, these are the old people, by the way, that just walked in and walked out. Rocco is not quite as old as I am, and Rob is almost a few years older than Rocco. And this is one thing that keeps WCOM going is the there is no age limit. So we don't have to bail out of here.
Well, if there were, I'm guessing you wouldn't be around.
I'd be gone, right? My ability to get here is, can I drive and can I walk from my car into the studio? So back ETFs, but I have an ETF fund, and the advisor calls it a low volatility fund or something like that.
They do have those. Yeah. SPVL is one that's out there. It's called it's Standard & Poor's low volatility. One of the things that I mentioned is how do I build a portfolio, or how does rising tide?
I want you to tell me, because
build a portfolio, and I think that could be important for any listener or the listener out there. You start by doing a suitability interview, so to speak.
Yeah.
Suitability is a big watchword. Registered investment advisors, registered reps, brokers, everyone has certain standards, and we all have suitability requirements. So if at age 90 I were to say to you, I think you should put 50% of your portfolio in Amazon, Bill, because Amazon is really taking off, you better look at me like I'm crazy.
Right, I would.
because Amazon has a price-earnings ratio of – it's come way down. It's probably only about 75 or so now. I think the average in the
price earnings ratio. Define these things.
Basically, I'll give you a brief explanation. The earnings of a company are roughly equal to net profits.
Okay.
And if a company earns a dollar, and the stock sells for $20, then the price earnings ratio is 20. If it sells for $10, then the P.E. is 10. And if it sells for $50, then the P.E. is 50. It's a measurement of value, and there are many of them, but that's one of them. So essentially, when you are retired and you need your funds for income or stability, you probably don't want to be buying a whole lot of a stock that has a 75 price-earnings ratio when the average in the S&P 500 over the years is somewhere around 17.
Oh, is that right?
And the average today is probably in the 25-26 range.
Uh-huh.
Some people think stock market's overvalued now. There are many ways to measure that.
Yeah, you read it. You read the Wall Street Journal, and column A will say it one way, and next to it, column B will say just the opposite.
Well, that's why they have those financial programs on TV, and they never give just one opinion, do they?
No. So okay, so here we are back talking investment advice. When you're dealing with a client, how do you determine individually or mutually with the client which direction this person's investments are going to head?
Well, essentially,
and how much advice? How often do they say, "Oh, I want to buy Amazon"?
One of the main things that I have to do is I have to go through a questionnaire. We talk about goals. We talk about time frames.
Uh-huh.
We talk about current assets. We talk about income. We talk about different things that the client may have at work. And, you know, just try to get an entire picture of the circumstances and then do a risk profile. Because, you know, technically you could be 30 years old and be very conservative.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
sure.
I would probably talk to that 30-year-old about time frame and about having the ability to recover from maybe market drops or issues. But in essence, a client brings to the table their own risk profile.
I
have to identify that risk profile, and I am responsible for keeping that and the suitability information on file and available to any regulator that may come in and want to look at it. They may even want to look at the suitability and risk profile and compare it to the portfolio to determine whether Rising Tide or any other investment advisory service or any broker is doing what the client's risk profile and suitability determine they should do.
How often do regulators mess around with responsible advisors such as yourself?
Oh, it could be once every couple, 3 years.
Based on complaints, based on just they just make the rounds?
Both. If there were a complaint
or questions,
I'm happy to say that Rising Tide Incorporated has never had a formal complaint. Now, that doesn't mean that we've never had a client that complained about one thing or another from time to time.
That's right. In your world, you've got to do that, right?
But never had a formal complaint filed with any regulatory body. So one of the ways that the regulators just keep tabs on things is doing regular rounds.
Okay.
And
this would be the Federal Trade the
well, it's
SEC.
It depends on the amount of assets under management. The SEC comes in at around 100 million. Used to be 25 million under uh-huh. management, but now it's around 100 million. And the states regulate advisors with less than 100 million. Rising Tide is currently in the $50 million range.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And so we have state regulation.
Well, the states, do they, the regulation people looking for the same issues?
I would think in essence, or federal? In essence, yes. You know, they ask a lot of questions. They want to know that you have contracts. They want to know that you have the suitability and risk information. They want to know.
So you have to keep a pretty active file on your clients,
oh, yeah.
don't you?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. They want to know what kind of practices you have for buying and selling securities. They want to know that you have records. They want to know if you have discretion over your clients' accounts or if it's non-discretionary and you have to talk to the client every time before you make a buy or a sell.
Okay. Yeah, discretionary would be you want non-discretionary, I imagine.
Well, no. I want I want discretion. In other words, I want Rising Tide to be given discretion over making investment decisions, because if you have to track down someone and you need to sell something, it could be difficult.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And sometimes prices move so fast that you may even miss an opportunity to buy or sell something that would have been suitable for the client. So I'd say 97% of my relationships are discretionary.
Okay. Now, you mentioned in your notes how do you handle volatility situations, like volatile market. I don't know whether you consider this market we're in now as really volatile. It does bounce around, but...
You know, I think December of 2018 was a good example of volatility. I think for the month, the S&P 500 was down around 8%. And most folks think that that's a pretty good movement, pretty significant movement. A correction is usually identified as a 10% drop from peak to trough. And routinely, if I determine, and I have sources other than my own crystal ball, other than my own reading, other than my own intuition. But if we are able to determine that we're in a correction, there's a reasonable probability that there won't be a whole lot of buying or selling. There might be buying at the end or when we think that we're at the lowest point.
Right.
But there's rarely any selling, because the idea of a correction is a relatively short-lived downturn.
I notice in days when the market goes way down at the early part of the day, the downward trend reverses often during the day, and it's still down, but the downer is not as large.
Well, it
and
certainly
then people
can.
Will start buying then. I
it
assume.
Certainly can. There have, for instance. And I do not know Warren Buffett personally. I'm only going to say something about him because of reading.
Okay.
But oftentimes Warren Buffett and Berkshire Hathaway will pick a price that they will buy a company at.
Uh-huh.
And I say company as opposed to stock, because that's what they're looking at.
Right.
They're looking at something like if they want to own the whole company. They don't buy the whole company.
Right.
But so they have a price.
Uh-huh.
And if their intrinsic value for a company has X price and the market gives them that X price, they're likely to buy it there.
Yeah.
And they may or may not sell when it reaches full value, because sometimes they just look at the story again and say, okay, we like this company. We're going to hold on to it.
Well, you can do the same thing.
Sure. It's true.
Yeah.
And so volatility if we have an event, say a financial crisis like occurred in 2007 and pretty much destroyed the stock market in 2008 and ended up going, I think the S&P 500 was down 55% from late 07 to early 09. That might be an occasion to sell something early on if you can identify it and to try to limit exposure in the stock market. Once again, it depends on suitability and the way that what kind of relationship you have with your client.
So how did that affect you and your business in those years?
Well, I have some resources that told me to get out of the stock market in January of 2008.
Okay.
And I followed their advice to a large extent.
What do you mean, get out of the stock market? You have to go someplace.
That means sell individual securities and stock funds and either be in a money market or be in some kind of short-term bond fund.
So your clients didn't suffer too much. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I can't really talk about that on the air because it hasn't passed any compliance.
Yeah.
And we're very well regulated. But I will just say that Rising Tide sold a significant amount of stock assets early in 2008.
Okay, well, so you were ready for what was going to happen. You folks out there listening to a very erudite discussion of investment advice with the master advisor, Tim Hux. This is WCOM, your voice in the community, and the community here in Carver today is a hot, cloudy day. I suppose before I go home this evening, there'll be thunderstorms. But anyway, you can come by here. The radio station is attached to the front of the world-famous Arts Center. You can stick a check in an envelope under the door, and you'll get full credit. We are a nonprofit organization, and anything you give to us in a way of a contribution is tax-deductible. Or you can go to our website, which many people do, wcomfm.org, and make a safe and secure donation. And those donations are really welcome. Without your help out there, whether it's people from Carborough, Chapel Hill, or elsewhere, and there are many of our donations come from elsewhere, these lights wouldn't be on, and I wouldn't be having this stimulating conversation with Tim Hux today about the world of investment. What about all these crazy stock like Google and Amazon and the companies that I think they're air. They're not products.
Well, not quite.
Amazon just does it. All it does is move stuff.
Well, you know, there are people far more educated and far more intelligent than I am that give Amazon credit for keeping inflation low. Now, not Amazon by itself.
Yeah,
there are a lot of technology companies. In other words, Amazon and eBay and companies of that nature have given Americans and the world. There are Chinese companies that do similar things. Have given them a platform and a marketplace that is highly competitive. Now, yes, they deliver things to your door, and yes, brick and mortar retail really has to scramble to try to keep up, and firms like Walmart and Kohl's and other brick and mortar retail shops have tried to really make a robust online service to match what companies like Amazon are doing. So I do think it keeps prices down. Also, companies like Netflix. I have no statistics on attending movie theaters, but my guess is that attendance is probably down some since Netflix hit the marketplace.
Some movie theaters actually have closed. Some of the big movie theaters in shopping malls and so forth have closed.
And we can also give Google credit for information services. you know, you no longer have to buy a book or, I mean, not that you don't want to, but you can gather information without having the World Book Encyclopedia or the Britannica or whatever.
It's right.
We've really had some significant changes. Well, there have been changes forever, but these have been high-level changes.
What's the long-term lifespan for these kind of companies, though?
Well, you know, Google is expanding. Google, Amazon are expanding into all different types of things.
Facebook.
Facebook is trying to control every aspect of your life. they have these companies, but even Microsoft.
Yeah.
Microsoft has appreciated, I'm doing this from memory, has appreciated about 200% in the last 5 years.
Yeah, I know. It has big growth.
And it's a huge company. They're almost $1 trillion in market cap. In other words, if you were to own all of their stock, it would be worth almost a trillion. It's over $900 billion.
Yeah.
They've appreciated nearly 1,000% in 10 years, I think. Now, don't quote me on this. This may not be totally accurate.
But I did numbers, read about that, though,
But the numbers are significant.
Right.
Netflix, I think their price-earnings ratio is something like 125, which is way high. But I think the last 5 years, they've appreciated in stock value about 580% or something like that. So Facebook, not so much, because they've been hammered a little bit lately due to their court cases, et cetera, and their breaches of data storage. So, but these are the kind of companies that, although they don't make widgets, they don't make automobiles.
That's right, they don't make anything.
They have a huge advertising and capture of eyeballs.
Well, wouldn't that be more volatile, though?
Potentially, yes. I mean, just look at Apple, for instance. Apple's a manufacturing company.
Now, they make something, right.
They make things, mostly phones.
Right.
They're trying to transition into a pay-for-service type company.
Okay.
They're struggling with that a little bit now. Out of these companies that we mentioned, Apple has a reasonable price-earnings ratio of somewhere in the neighborhood of 15 or so.
Okay.
They have appreciated about 1,000% in the last 10 years, and I can't remember what it is in the last 5 years. Not as much. But they are essentially a manufacturing company that is hurt more recently by tariffs on Chinese products.
Right, because they make a lot of their stuff in
some
China.
Some of their components
are Chinese.
Come from China, and some of their assembly
Is
in China.
Well, what do you, how do you, these stocks get so much publicity. What about your clientele? What are they telling you or asking you, or how do you handle that with them?
You know, I'd be lying if I didn't say that I had clients that say, what about X or what about Y?
Yeah.
And if I look at it and I think it's a reasonable thing to do, and I think if I think it fits their suitability model.
Which has to be the answer, I guess, in every case.
Then I might say, yes, let's do something.
Uh-huh.
You know, take, for instance, marijuana stocks.
Yeah, oh yeah.
There's a great...
I get stuff in my email every day about CBD.
There's a great market in Canada. It's legal in Canada for both medicinal and recreational use. But it's almost like the internet companies and the internet service providers when we first started out. You know, companies like Earthlink or WorldCom or some of the ones that have just either gone way down in the public's image or usage. You know, AOL, for instance.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's...
You never hear about that anymore.
Not anymore. That's gone, right.
So, you know, marijuana companies are going to be like that.
Yeah.
I think Amazon has established a position, but... You know, they could be way overvalued, and if we have a recession, and people stop buying so much, and they're it's something we call price to perfection. As long as inflation is low, interest rates are low, the economy's great, everybody's working, people are buying stuff every day. You know, there's a UPS truck in your or a FedEx truck in your driveway every day bringing you something. Then that's going to be great. But if things slow down significantly and your valuation is way, way, way high, it can come way, way, way down.
Well, how about the money world is always something showing up.
Sure.
Like the latest issue we've had for the last couple of years is this cryptic money, bitcoins.
You know, I claim no knowledge.
I imagine you don't push
no
that.
No knowledge of cryptocurrency. I've had a couple of conversations with some people that know what they're talking about.
Have you had a couple of conversations with people who have invested and found success or failure?
Yes, 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 I have. I mean, I had a gentleman last year tell me that he has made more money in trading cryptocurrency than he did in his tech job.
Oh, really?
So, yes, he built a house and so on and so forth. And so I guess if you know what you're – you can – there have been currency traders for centuries.
Yeah.
As long as currency has been in –
well, currency's
vogue.
Hard.
Currency is fiat. Currency is a government-backed something. It's a ledger.
Right.
But full faith and credit of the United States means something.
Yeah.
So their currency is worth something as compared to, say, maybe a – I don't want to pick out any country specifically. Yeah, well, but a third world country that issues currency.
Pick out Kazakhstan. That's an interesting country.
Would not be as well respected and would not be as highly valued.
But bitcoins are right out of the air, and I don't have the slightest knowledge of where the hard cash comes to support it.
I mean, the truth of it all is that it's something called blockchain is a different way to handle ledgers. Everything we do economically is a ledger. It's all built on faith and trust.
Okay.
So if I hand you a $10 bill, you're going to trust that you can go to a store and buy $10 worth of goods today. It's just a piece of paper, Bill.
Uh-huh. That's true.
If the American economy were to collapse or the dollar were to not be the currency of business in the world, then that $10, what it's worth today, might be like a dollar,
mm-hmm.
you know, next year.
Mm-hmm.
So,
like the world in Venezuela.
So, you know, don't count out these cryptocurrencies and this blockchain ledger just yet. We might see some real movement and some, real currency use, but we don't know. I don't know.
So if I want to invest in bitcoins, who do I call? I don't call you.
No, you don't call me. You better Google it.
And okay, just do it online and take your chances.
I mean, you know, I've seen that stuff go from 20,000 whatever per unit to 3,000 per unit and vice versa.
Yeah, so I know. Do you know anybody who's fooling around with it?
Nope.
Okay.
I do not.
And when your people ask you about it, you tell them the same thing you're telling me, I guess.
Nobody really asked me about it.
Oh, that's good news.
Well, at least my clients don't.
Yeah. Now, another point you mentioned in your note that I got today, what is an inverted yield curve and what does it mean for the U.S. economy? Well, that's a whole question on a final exam.
So have you
yield curve.
Have you heard anything about inverted yield curve?
No.
It was a very popular topic in economics last fall.
Okay, inverted yield curve.
Now, yield curve is it basically envision a graph. And on the left-hand side of the graph are – we'll use treasuries as an example. On the left-hand side of the graph are Treasury bills,
okay,
which can be from 1 week up to 2 years. And in the middle of the graph are Treasury notes, which can go from 2 years to 10 years in maturity. And then on the far right-hand side of the graph will be Treasury bonds, which are 20- and 30-year issue securities. Well, usually, because of interest rate risk, meaning the Fed controls interest rates, the marketplace determines interest rates, usually the longer-term bonds are going to have higher rates. And usually the shorter...
Higher rates, okay.
Usually the shorter-term securities, less than a year, 2 years, are going to have lower rates, annual rates. So when the Fed comes in and decides they're going to raise interest rates, they are raising short-term rates.
Right.
As a matter of fact, they have what they call overnight rates.
Oh, really?
That a bank can borrow from the Fed for a certain interest rate.
Uh-huh.
And usually it's not just overnight, but that's what they call
it.
And these are short terms. So most money market instruments are short, what we call short-term paper. Now, don't fall asleep because I know this is...
I'm not closing my eyes. I'm trying to concentrate.
It gets rather technical. But the bottom line is... When I buy a bond, I'm buying a stream of income.
Okay.
And if my stream of income is over 30 years, I got a whole lot more risk in that.
Yeah.
Than if it's over 6 months.
Sure. Okay.
Because at the end of 6 months, I'm going to get all my money back from the U.S. government.
Uh huh.
But I have to wait for 30 years if I got a 30-year bond.
Right.
Well, that's why they normally have to pay higher interest rates.
Sure. Okay.
But sometimes the Fed is going to take away the punch bowl. In other words, the economy is going well, interest rates are low. The threat or the fear is that inflation will rear its ugly head and it will rise and the purchasing power of your dollar will go down. For those of you that have a couple of years on you, think 1978, 79, and 80, when prime rate was around 18 and some of the mortgage rates approached 20%. That's a no-no. That's bad. It's not quite as bad as deflation because deflation is despair.
I know. You don't like to hear that word.
But high inflation just robs people of the purchasing power. So that's when automobile prices went from $3,000 to $10,000 and $15,000 in a relatively short period of time. So anyway, bottom line, on this inverted yield curve, if short-term rates get higher than long-term rates, that's generally a bad sign. It means that the economy is slowing down. It means that the faith, both the public and the economists' faith in the long-term economy is waning, and often indicates a recession is coming. You know, sometimes it's 6 months, sometimes it's a year, sometimes it's 18 months. But usually, if you have an inverted yield curve for a long period of time, you're probably going to go into recession.
Okay, so where are we?
We had an inverted curve back in December. The rates have stabilized. Longer term rates have gone up some.
Yeah.
The shorter-term rates have remained rather stable. I think the Fed is pegging their Fed funds rate at between 2.25% and 2.5%. The 10-year notes are higher than the 6-month notes, and the 30 years are higher than the 10 years, but not a lot. There's not a ton of room in there.
So this doesn't have too much effect with day-to-day work with your clients.
No, but what it tells me, it's kind of an indicator. It tells me that we may be toward the end of a long-term expansion. And we're talking about it's been a 10-year expansion. I know, nearly a 10-year expansion.
Yeah. Well, we have other people in this organization that sometimes stop by. Famous Rocco has just stopped by, you're allowed one question, Rocco, or maybe two.
Well,
Rocco was our Saturday morning star, if you don't know it, from 9 to noon every Saturday, the music hall, and he plays music that you really want to listen to.
Well, Bill, it's a pleasure to be on with you. And, Tim, it's always, always good to see you. And you've been on Music Hall, and we've hosted this show together.
I love Music Hall.
Well, thank you so much. I'd like to ask you one question. One question.
I hope I have an answer.
Well, this is a general type question, but what kind of advice would you give a young person, someone in their 20s, that is just getting started, where to invest their money or how to invest it over the long haul? What would be the best?
One primary advice, and I'm really not supposed to be giving advice over the radio, so it won't be specific advice except to say save. Save till it hurts. I mean, we talk about the ouch factor in my business. Now, I understand you have to pay your bills, and you cannot save if you can't pay your bills. And don't build up. Do not build up a heavy credit card debt. That's almost the worst thing you can do. Because if you're going to be charged 18 or 20%, and you say, oh, that looks good, I'd like to have that, I'm going to put that on my credit card, that will kill you eventually. Yeah. So the idea is if you can, pay off your cards on a monthly basis. If you can, save something every paycheck. If you're employer offers a 401k or some kind of retirement plan, participate in it, especially if there's a match. If they're going to match 3% of your salary, or if they're going to match 6% of your salary, put that amount in, because you just made 100% return on your money.
So you would say save as much as you can, stay out of debt.
And keep it. It sounds like common sense, and sometimes common sense is relatively uncommon.
That's good. That's advice we all have to pay attention to, isn't it, Rocco?
Sure.
Yep. Absolutely. Well, thank you for coming here and advising us. I love to talk with people who really know what they're talking about, and I'll give you credit for that. Now, the sports shows we have with Bob Ward, I'm not sure you know everything that you tell me you think you know. And we'll do that again maybe in August if I'm still doing this show. Anyway, Tim and his company, Rising Tide, are an underwriter of this particular show, Time Out. And Mike Cotter, retired ambassador. Have you met Mike Cotter? I think you have.
I've never met him personally, I don't think.
But he's been on the show maybe 15 or 20 times, and he's also an underwriter of this show. And, Rocco, you know Mike very well.
I do.
And who else do we have? We have MidCap Advisors, which is a merger and acquisition company based in New York City. And we also have support from the Ryan Research Center of Durham, which is a continuing study of parapsychology and consciousness in the context of the paranormal and exceptional experiences. You can learn more from them by going to www.ryan.org. Now, Tim, do you have an email or place where people want to deal with you?
Tim@RisingTideInc, and the Inc is INC, RisingTideInc.com. And if someone wants to make a phone call, I'm at 919-819-2086.
Okay, that's it, folks. I hope you got that email and the phone call.
There's also a website, and it's very similar, www.risingtideinc.com.
It's a name hard to forget, right, Rocco?
I hear you, Bill.
Next week is Memorial Day. And as I told Rob Westerman, the previous show, right before mine, we're going to play World War II music next week. I have a lot of that music at home. And in honor of Memorial Day, we won't have a live guest next year in town that day, Rocco.
If I'm here, I will come in.
Because last time we played music, you were a big help because you were around so long time ago, you know half of these people. Anyway, that's it. That's it for another. Stay tuned for the Bachelor Pad, which follows this show at 6 o'clock. And tune in next week for some World War II music. And Tim, thanks again. It's been great.
I enjoyed it. Thank you.